HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 127, recorded live Monday, August 25th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott and Carl talk about what's new in .NET 3.5 Service Pack 1.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting down today with my good friend Carl Franklin. He's back again, and
yes,
we're talking about .NET 3.5 Service Pack 1.
Yes.
As I like to call it, .NET 3.6.
Yeah, should be.
Don't
should
like
be.
Me calling it that.
Should be .NET 3.6.
There's a lot of stuff in it. I don't know why it was called SP1, but it's got a lot to it. There's a lot of additional functionality.
Well, when you add new features like the Entity Framework and Astoria ADO.NET Data Services, it really should be something other than a service pack. Because to me, service packs are updates to existing features.
Exactly. And I would tend to agree. I think things got a little strange when .NET 3.0 came out. I think we can all agree that it was 2.0 additional libraries.
Right. That should have been 2.1.
But interestingly, it was a lot of stuff. I mean, game-changing big stuff. WCF, WPF, totally new ways of thinking about something. I don't know if WPF would I don't think you could fairly say that that would be 2.1. That's a pretty big deal. You know, but 3.0, I don't know. Certainly it couldn't have been called, 2.0 plus pack. That wouldn't have done it justice.
Well, I think the confusion there was that the framework was essentially, the CLR was essentially still 2.0.
Right.
But there was new features added to it.
Exactly. Because with 1.0, we had a CLR. 1.1, we had some bug fixes. And
another CLR.
Another CLR, interestingly enough. And then 2.0, we had a vastly different CLR.
Yeah.
People just kind of assumed, and I think it made sense. I think that the getting versioning right on something like that, when you've got the framework, the base class library, and additional libraries, is tough.
It's just so big. Yeah.
It is big. I would have called it probably 3.8, I think would have been a good number. But regardless, there's a lot of stuff in it, but it's important for people to remember that it's still .NET 2.0.
So this is not only .NET 3.5 SP1, but it's also Visual Studio 2008 SP1.
Right, so you can have a machine that's got .NET 3.5 on it, and then you can update it to 3.5 SP1. And then if you have a developer's machine that's got Visual Studio 2008, you would want to update Visual Studio itself to Service Pack 1. That would update, the development environment, and you get all sorts of new features there. And then the underlying CLR, the 2.0 CLR, is moving from Service Pack 1 to Service Pack 2. So they're fixing a lot of CLR bugs in the process as well. And I think that those things will hopefully get tidied up with .NET 4 or whatever they're going to call it in the future. But, and believe me, I've only worked at the company for, I think I'm a year next week, actually. I've been the company 51 weeks.
So let's talk a little bit about the Entity Framework.
Yeah, the Entity Framework was an interesting one because this is the object relational mapper.
Well, not just that, but it's they're pushing it as a standard data model, the entity data model, which is going to be consumed by multiple Microsoft applications. And of course, it is an ORM tool. They didn't do things.
Yeah,
kind of an ORM. They didn't do things quite the same as some of the other mainstream ORMs did. And, it's drawn its criticisms for not having this and that.
There was a vote of no confidence, and the guys at the Alt.NET podcast had a very interesting podcast about that vote. This was basically a bunch of the Alt.NET guys got together and signed a petition, as well as a lot of other people, and they presented that petition to the team. It was a little dramatic, but I think that the point is that they want them to succeed, they want it to be better, and they didn't think that it made it there.
Well, I talked to Franz Boma with Richard today in a show, in a .NET Rock show that we're, Franz Boma, excuse me, he corrected me on his pronunciation. He's the author of LLBL Gen, which is a very popular ORM tool. And I asked him what he thought about that. And he said, it mostly comes from the point that all of those guys are consultants that make their living with ORM tools, and they get into a situation where the project manager insists that they use the Entity Framework, and of course it, you know, doesn't have some of the features that they want, right. And therein lies their beef.
Well, I think this is one of the things that culturally needs to kind of stop is that, you know, a lot of big companies, a lot of big enterprises will use what Microsoft produces, right? They wouldn't use Monorail, but they'll use ASP.NET MVC. They won't use Hibernate, but they'll use Entity Framework. You know, and then that's their prerogative. But one of the things that I think is nice and is representative of the 3.5 SP1 stuff is that more of these things are getting along better with the third party stuff. You know, and Link is kind of the great equalizer, but you know, you see that the stuff that Phil's doing with ASP.NET MVC is certainly getting along well with all the other third-party...
Phil Hack,
yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, that's one thing to point out about Service Pack 1 of 3.5 is that it does not include ASP.NET MVC. There was some confusion about that. It was always intended that MVC would be a separate release or an RTW release to web at some point in a future month that ends in Burr, like March Burr. Or January Burr.
June Burr.
But yeah, a lot of people thought that they installed 3.5 SP1 and they said, wait a second, where's MVC? In fact, we did get some pieces of MVC and some artifacts like routing, which was a portion of MVC that was recognized early on as being really valuable and then pulled into ASP.NET dynamic data and then ultimately was moved out of system.web.mvc.routing and pushed up. It's now system.web.routing. So routing itself is a part of ASP.NET proper now and something that you can count on whether you use MVC or dynamic data or neither.
So the next big feature, ADO.NET Data Services. Now, I know you've done a Hansel Minute show on this or two.
Yeah, and I'm actually going to be going to Australia later this week, and I'm going to give a talk at TechEd Australia on ADO.NET Data Services, formerly Astoria.
This is very exciting.
I like it. I really think it's really cool because I spend many, many years trying to get data over WS Star.
Right, and, the web services stack.
Exactly. People call it WS Death Star because it's just very imposing. There's a lot going on there.
So what they've done here is they've simplified things and they've gone back to what they call just simple REST, which is representational state transfer.
Which is essentially HTTP. Create, read, update, delete over some common HTTP verbs like get, post, put, and delete. But also the concept that data, these in this case, entities are resources, web resources. So any one entity should be addressable via a URL. I can pull back an Atom feed, an Atom pub feed of these different entities. So I could go and say, you know, hanselman.com/northwind.service/products and get back a feed. A syndication feed in a syndication format where the payload for that feed is not a blog and not blog items, but rather entity XML, and you know, a format that I could consume. What's cool about this is it makes, frankly, getting stuff over the web easier. They've got clients in for Ajax. They're working on a client for Silverlight. You can very, very easily add these services using the same WCF add service reference right-click menu from Visual Studio that you're used to doing now, and make WinForms, WebForms applications that very, very easily then bind to these collections. Basically, you've got link to REST, which is pretty sweet.
Do you think that this is a pushback, a simplification, a pushback from the complexity of SOAP and particularly WSDL, but maybe SOAP, WSDL, UDDI, the whole WS stack?
My knee-jerk reaction was that this was a rejection. But I'm realizing that it is simply different. It's a parallel track. It is CRUD. It's get, read, update, and delete. It's not necessarily message passing over SOAP with all of the headers and security and all the different extensions and the formalization of the SOAP protocol.
Okay.
I could see building systems that you would use both. It solves a problem. You know, it certainly would solve the problem that I had, which was moving accounts and money around. I was trying to go and make web services like get account request would be a message and you'd pass it in to get accounts and da, da, da. I was trying to model REST over this message passing format. And when I learned about REST, I said, well, this is what I was trying to solve. That doesn't mean it matches every problem. It just means it happened to match the one that I was working on.
Also, a lot of team system improvements.
I'm not really familiar with a lot of the team system stuff. I know that there's been a lot of improvements on the backside for the team foundation server, Service Pack 1. A lot of database and optimizations for big change sets.
Yep, some version control fixes and automatically supporting non-solution controlled files, for example. Some work item tracking, Office 2007 integration. Using a ribbon. A source safe migration tool, support for SQL Server 2008 with Team Foundation.
Source safe migration tool. Wow.
Yeah. So there's some really good stuff.
Applause.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sooner we get off source safe, the better the world will be.
Yeah. And we used to say that about, never mind.
Of course. ASP.NET dynamic data.
Yeah.
I think that, all the MVC is getting people not thinking about dynamic data. You know, we did a talk with dynamic data with the PM, Scott Hunter, recently. And I'm starting to figure this thing out even more. You know, I thought it was scaffolding. It's not scaffolding. It's more than that. I thought it was, a jump-starting way to make, more web forms faster. But they're going to be doing an MVC version. So you'll be able to generate, MVC-style pages. But you can just take a regular old web forms page, right? A regular old web forms project that you're already working on, drop a dynamic data manager control on that form, and drop a list view in. And you're starting to think about dynamic data. You don't necessarily have to go and make a quote unquote dynamic data website.
They sort of pushed it as sort of scaffolding.
Well, I think that the scaffolding demo was easy. You know, this is one of the things that's difficult. You want to show someone something. You want to show them the elevator speech, right? Mm. There's nothing quite faster than file new awesome demo.
I guess they also wanted to get the Rails crowd listening.
Well, scaffolding is sexy. It's great to be able to get up and fast quickly. Up and fast quickly. What am I saying? It's nice to be able to just say, look, boom, Northwind. So I built a whole website. No code.
Right.
But, I've talked to Peter Blum, right? Peter Blum. I love Peter
Blum.
Yeah,
yeah. Peter's awesome.
Yeah. He is scary smart about this stuff. And something clicked for him a couple of months ago on dynamic data, and he just said, oh, this is something I can, and you watch the control vendors. This is a guy who is going to exploit the hell out of dynamic data.
I believe
it. And he's one of the guys who helped explain it to me. And it started to click. And I started to realize that this is a more interesting meta templating system, meta programming system than it is, code generation. We've got lots of new videos up at ASP.NET/dynamic data talking about that. And, I've got to figure out more effective ways to explain dynamic data to people because it's so easy to just dismiss it and go, it's dynamic data.
There's some new stuff in Ajax too, apparently.
Yeah, Bertrand Leroy and those guys in the Ajax ASP.NET team added some browser history stuff. Now, this is really, I don't quite get it because JavaScript still is magic to me, but basically they've got techniques to put points in history. Basically, they can do different techniques based on the browser, right? So they've actually got an abstraction layer over the top of a number of techniques. So, for example, you might have a tiny iframe that you can't see, and that iframe will navigate forward to other fake pages when you do an Ajax action. So you might, let's say, you have an accordion control. The accordion control would be like the thing in Office or Outlook 2007, and you click from mail to calendar. You get to decide if you want the clicking on that accordion control to be a point in the history. So then it manages that and fools the browser into thinking that a forward navigation has occurred, such that you can then back up an Ajax, an Ajax or JavaScript style.
Yeah, because that's been
event.
That's been a particularly difficult thing to do in the browser with Ajax. How do I undo? Yeah.
Oh yeah, you can't take over the back button, right? A lot of people will say, early on with Ajax applications, you hit the back button accidentally, and suddenly you lose your entire application.
Well, nor do you want to. I mean, the back button is not a solution because it's not plugged into the architecture.
Right. Well, the idea though was that people are used to moving forward in pages.
Yeah.
They click on something and the page changes dramatically. They would expect hitting back would undo that.
Right.
But an Ajax application like early versions of Gmail would stay on the same page forever.
Yeah.
Gmail is a great example of an application that does browser history really nicely.
Yes.
You can click on different categories and hit back, and you'll go right back where you were. Hi, it's Scott here from Another Place in Time. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I apologize for interrupting it, but I wanted to let you know that assembling a podcast like this every week isn't free. Certainly the bandwidth bill crushes us every month, so I want to let you know that this show is sponsored by Telerik. They make the show possible, and they make some pretty cool products as well. For example, if you're trying to build a Web 2.0 Ajaxy application, trying to use the Web 1.0 components, it's kind of difficult. You got to get the next-gen stuff if you want to build the next-gen websites, and that's exactly what the folks at Telerik have got in their new upcoming product, which is codenamed Rad Controls Prometheus. It's a big pack of web controls built entirely on top of the Microsoft ASP.NET Ajax stuff that you already understand. It's going to give you a lot of performance and interactivity on your next project. They mirror the ASP.NET Ajax API, so the development's really straightforward. Client scripts are shared, loading time is pretty fast. You set a couple of properties, you can even bind to web services for a really efficient operation. The new RAD editor for ASP.NET Ajax loads up to 4 times faster than before, and the RAD grid will do thousands of records in milliseconds. But of course, it's better to try these things for yourself, so you can visit telerik.com/ASP.NET Ajax and download a trial. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll get right back to the show.
Hey, can I get off on a tangent for a second? Have you noticed some weird things with Gmail lately in the browser?
In what sense?
What can I say?
I've noticed it's been a little slower lately. I had it down for a couple hours last week.
Getting into circular errors?
You know, that's funny. I've actually noticed more errors, just flat out errors, on Gmail in the last kind of month than ever before.
Yeah, me too.
I've noticed it was down for like 4 or 5 hours a couple of weeks ago.
That's right.
Which was bizarre. I thought the world was ending. I had no idea. I'd never expected that to be done. And then I would get these weird kind of server error. It was kind of these cutesy messages like something went wrong.
Check back in a few minutes. We're fixing the problem. Yeah. But I have these weird cyclical problems. Like I'll get into this situation where it keeps refreshing the page over and over again and nothing ever happens. Hmm. And the box comes up that says, you know, in Internet Explorer, do you want to allow secure and non-secure items? And it'll just, I'll keep pressing yes.
Oh,
and I have
to
switch to basic
Google Apps for your domain?
Yes.
Okay. So I found that turning off the chat in Gmail will get rid of that error.
Oh, really? Because
apparently
don't
the chat widget is insecure while Gmail is secure.
Really?
So if you go to the scroll to the very, very bottom of the browser, it says standard without chat.
Well, that's
and
what
mobile.
I do. If I go to standard view, which is not the Ajax view, that's the only way that I can do that. And then after hitting standard, I can go back to the or if I go to simple, basic HTML view, rather, and then back to standard view. That's the only way I can get around it.
Try the standard view, the Ajax view, minus the chat widget.
Yeah, I'm turning off the chat, that's for
and
sure.
And see if that makes it.
It's interesting, though. You know, Google is seen as this, you know, perfect, simple little application that all the magic happens on the back end. And we don't realize they're a company like everybody else.
Well, I think
with their own problems.
You know, it's interesting. You know, Microsoft certainly got its problems, and I know them as much as anybody. But I have noticed in the last 6 months, Google and Apple, kind of the shine has come off.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that in a kind of crabs in a bucket. You know, hey, they're trying to climb out of the bucket. Let's jump on their back. But I mean is that writing good software is hard.
You know what happens.
And it's just nice for people to realize that it's hard.
You know what happens is they're finally getting critical mass, you know, the sort of numbers of customers that Microsoft is used to dealing with. And now they have to worry about backward compatibility and this kind of stuff that Microsoft's had to deal with forever.
Sure.
You know, this is what happens when you have millions and millions and millions of customers. I have a MacBook Pro. I'm using it right now. I think it's a great, wonderful, well-designed, beautiful machine, but it crashes regularly.
Yeah, and I've got a MacBook Pro. I've also got a Mac Mini. The wife uses the Mac regularly to browse. I think of the Mac as my couch computer. That's the machine that's next to the couch.
Yeah.
I just grab it.
Yeah.
You know, Safari crashes all the time.
It does.
You know, bad plugins are bad plugins. Browsers crash.
Well, I think a lot of Windows people have sort of bought into the hype from the other side that, oh, Macs are these perfect things that never crash and never have viruses and never have bugs and everything. I mean, that's what you would think from those freaking commercials.
Well, you know, the only way that you can really get educated about this is to try different operating systems.
Right.
I mean, that's why I've got an Ubuntu machine, you know, and what's great about the Ubuntu machine, what's so funny about it is that the shell will crash, right? Like GNOME will crash, like the Explorer equivalent. But the kernel never dies, right? Because you know the machine's going, you can see the hard drive going, but you destroyed the UI, the X server is shut down, and you're back at the command line.
Yeah. But hey, we digress.
Oh, yeah. Vista's like that, too. You know, Explorer will crash, and Vista will just keep going forever.
Really quick, great feature that I love about 3.5 Service Pack 1, JavaScript IntelliSense.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. This is huge. This is huge. This is inside of Visual Studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, one of the things that Scott, this is like, I think this is Scott Gu's most favorite new feature because he talks about this one constantly. But this is the idea that you can annotate your JavaScript with enough information that it's able to give you really, really smart IntelliSense. Yeah. And it'll work on jQuery, on Prototype, Scriptaculous, ext.js, all that stuff.
It's awesome.
And particularly for jQuery, I think that Visual Studio Service Pack 1 really makes jQuery a joy.
For anybody who's not using XML literals.
Oh, yeah.
And the whole, you know,
Well, there's also some other stuff that's kind of deep inside of Visual Studio that's subtle.
Linked to XML,
it's the kind of things that people care about. Like if you go Tools Options and go under the text editor, there's a whole new section under Formatting that you can basically set your preferences for how you want your JavaScript formatted, much like you want your C# or your VB formatted. So you can say things like, I want a completed block when I close a curly brace, or make spaces after comma delimiters, all the kind of stuff that once you have a page or two of code, you'd like it to be tidy.
Yeah.
And you'd like to be able to say, this is how I want my stuff formatted. It's buried. I mean, it's inside the depths, but for people who care about that stuff, it's cool that they're still paying attention, you know?
There's a lot of things we haven't talked about. The WPF and Visual Designer improvements.
Yeah.
Very cool stuff, a writable bitmap that enables real-time bitmap updates from a software surface. Very cool stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I'm not a WPF expert, but there's some very cool features in there. There's that hardware acceleration stuff that the effects. So
in WPF, there's this notion of capabilities tiers. Basically, how much of the WPF stuff can we push up into the hardware?
Yeah.
And like, for example, there was a feature called bitmap effects that was a way to do things like glows and
blurring and drop shadowing and all that.
There's a thing called shader effects, which is explicitly hardware accelerated in Service Pack 1.
Yep.
Which is very cool. And then, of course, there's lots of CLR improvements to make WPF and WinForms apps start faster from a cold start.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so you'll find that your existing applications will be snappier because of the way that memory is laid out.
I think they just pretty much across the board improve the performance of applications in SP1.
Well, there are a number of CLR improvements, but specifically, as I understand it, in the way that they laid out memory. And loading modules into memory such that they could be accessed very quickly.
Very cool.
So that stuff's all new, and things should feel 10-15% snappier with the depending on what you're trying to accomplish.
Yep.
Some of the other more subtle things that are cool, of course, is that they put back classic ASP IntelliSense. I don't know if you noticed that this was gone.
No, I didn't know that.
It's back.
I haven't done any classic ASP.
Well, it disappeared in Visual Studio 2008, and people freaked out. So it's back, and you can get regular classic ASP IntelliSense, rather, and as well as debugging. They basically incorrectly assumed that people weren't using classic ASP, which is a huge mistake.
Well, I know there's a new ribbon control, like an Office 2007 ribbon, which, by the way, I really love, and it didn't take long for me to figure it out. I was a little skeptical of the ribbon at first, and now I just totally love it.
That was a nice segue. I was very smooth. Directly from classic ASP into the future, futuristic ribbon control.
It was no segue.
I will segue from there even more comfortably to script combining. Have you seen the JavaScript script combining?
No, tell me.
So if you've got an application that's got like a pile of JavaScripts, just one after the other, that can turn into a lot of script source equals, a lot of HTTP calls back to the server. There's a thing called the composite script element.
Okay.
It sits on Script Manager, and it basically lets you put a bunch of script references inside it, and then they get combined on the server, and then you get a single script served back to the client. So you have fewer requests to the server.
So
what's cool about that is it'll actually work with both JavaScript that's on the disk, as well as JavaScript that's in a resource.
So you're saying it puts it all in one JS file? Is that what you're saying?
It dynamically combines the scripts into one file, and serves you just the one.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet. Like on my side, gosh, I probably got 7 or 8, right?
Yeah.
You can combine them all into one script. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that you would do, you know, sparingly, in the sense of you want to make sure you wouldn't just do it willy-nilly. You would want to decide which scripts that would be appropriate for.
Yeah.
But it's just little stuff like that. So there's a lot of tightening the screws, which I think is cool.
So before we end the show, I just want to say that I've been using Vista 64-bit on on another laptop now for a good 4 months.
Good, good. I finally got you hardcore in the 64-bit.
Well, I can't find anything bad about this computer or this operating system.
It's so much more stable. I've got my 64-bit.
It never crashes.
It never crashes. It just sits there. Once you've got solid drivers, and if you're having a problem, in my experience with Vista 64-bit, it's either that you're having bad disk drivers or bad video drivers. Once you get that solid, it just sits. It just rocks.
It totally rocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
64-bit is a really nice place to be.
Very happy
with
that.
Have we done a 64-bit show? We should do one about getting 32-bit applications to run, debugging .NET applications on 64-bit and all that kind of stuff.
We haven't.
Because a lot of people email me that they hear that I'm running 64-bit, and I'll say, you know, I'd like to upgrade to 64-bit, but I really don't know, should I do that? Can I still make 32-bit applications? What about Visual Studio? Is there a 64-bit version? You know, explaining all that would be a really good show.
Okay.
Cool.
I also, you know, I run every operating system here, back to Windows 2000, I think. I think I have a machine still running Windows 2000 somewhere. Mm-hmm. But I have XP on a few machines. I've got Server 2003 on a couple of servers. I've got Vista 64-bit on a laptop. I have XP in Parallels on my Mac OS, my MacBook. I have actually Server 2008 running as a workstation. And that is pretty amazing. Have you done a show on that?
You know, I haven't. And actually, someone accused me recently of talking about doing shows in the future and then forgetting.
Oh.
And someone said I should go back and look at our transcripts and search for, let's do a show on that. And then promise to do all those shows. Right. So we should get our transcript gnomes.
Well, that's a good one. That's a very good show. I'm very happy with it. You know, because Server 2008 is essentially the Vista core. Mm-hmm. And running as a 64-bit machine, you can do the tweaks to sort of make it really shine as a workstation.
Yeah, and one of these days, I'm going to have to take one of my machines and try the Win 2008 workstation.
And there's Aero. I mean, I have Aero. I have all the features that I have in Vista.
All the glass.
And somebody did some benchmarks on it that says that it runs faster, too. Like 17, 18% faster. But there are obviously some things that you don't get but I don't need them, so it worked out really well.
Yeah.
All right, Scott, I think that's a show, don't you think?
I think so. There's lots to talk about, but I would encourage people to check it out. Oh, and I wanted to introduce a website that I made. I'm still working on it. It's not quite there yet, but
okay.
If you go to www.smallest.net.com. Have you seen this?
No.
You got a browser?
Yeah.
Check it out.
Smallest.net.com.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Spell out .net.
Oh, okay.
So smallest.
D-O-T-N-E-T.
.com.
Get the smallest.net framework download possible.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a little one-page application that does one thing. It looks at your user agent and your OS and what version of your OS and your bitness and all that and says, here's about what we think it would take to get you up to 3.5 SP1.
Well, I'm using a Mac, but, you know, I also have...
Well, so what does it say?
Actually, it says, it looks like you're running a Mac. There's no .NET framework download from Microsoft for the Mac, but you might check out either Silverlight, which is a browser plugin that includes a small version of the .NET framework. Mm-hmm. You could also check out Mono, which is the open source platform that could run .NET on a Mac. Very cool. So let me run with Internet Explorer, though.
Okay.
Because I am running Parallels, and I can run them side by side.
Oh, okay, good. So we'll see what your Mac, what the VM of Vista inside your Mac is doing.
www, and this is XP, by the way, XP
okay.
Pro.
Okay, good.
www.smallest.dot.
Basically, there's a lot of people who think that the .NET framework itself is like a 250 meg thing.
Right.
You know, and it's just not. it's somewhere between 10 and 60 megs, sometimes 80, depending on what kind of prereqs you've already got. You
so
know?
This says, I can't tell if you've got .NET installed. Perhaps you don't have .NET installed, or perhaps your browser isn't letting me know.
This is Internet Explorer.
Yeah, Internet Explorer, but it's running parallels.
So scroll to the very, very bottom.
Okay.
And look at the user agent at the very bottom of the page.
It's Mozilla 4.0, compatible MSIE 6.0, Windows NT 5.1 SV1.
Yeah, so this is an XP. You don't have IE7, and looks like you don't have .NET, this little XP machine.
That's right.
All right, there you go.
And the reason is because Windows Update does not work on my Parallels installation of XP
scandalous,
Pro.
Scandalous, scandalous.
It will not install any updates.
Well, that's a whole other show right there.
Yeah, run a Mac. It's awesome. Never crashes. No problems.
All right.
Okay. Scott, have a good one. Give the best to the family.
All right. And I will talk to you guys next week on Hansel Minutes.